From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Writer Simon Winchester goes deep, literally, in his bestseller, Krakatoa, about Indonesia's great volcanic eruption. The Oxford-trained geologist and historian exposed the volcano's roots and the deep impact of its fury on the societies of Java and Sumatra. Now he's looking back in time to one of America's greatest natural disasters. This hour on Point, Simon Winchester on the great California earthquake of 1906 and its tremors today. But first, we begin very much in the present, in Pakistan, where today there are conflicting reports on rescue operations. The death toll from last week's devastating earthquake has been reported at 35,000 and could climb higher. Ron Morrow is South Asia Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He joins us now from Islamabad. Ron, thanks for being with us. What's the latest on the focus of Pakistan's and international rescue and relief efforts now?
Well, Pakistan is basically calling off the rescue effort for looking for people in the rubble. And yesterday already a French team pulled out of one of the most badly damaged cities, saying that technically it was impossible for anyone to still be alive. They said no miracles happen, but they thought that was very, very unlikely. And a British team was pulling out today. So pretty much the search for survivors in all of these flattened houses and in the landslides is basically over, and now it's everyone's turning their effort to the survivors.
So the dead and buried, wounded perhaps, being essentially written off as you describe it. What about the living population that is still at risk as a result of the quake? How large is it, Ron? Is it known?
Well, I think the numbers are still guesswork, whether it's 25,000 dead or 35,000 dead. But the challenge in the future to try and keep people alive is just enormous. I was lucky enough to get a helicopter trip up to the line of control, which is the ceasefire line between India and Pakistan.
In Kashmir, yes.
High up in the mountains near the epicenter of the earthquake. The entire area is totally cut off from the rest of the world. The only way in there is by helicopter. All the roads are covered by landslides for miles and miles and miles. And the villagers up there have absolutely nothing. Their homes have been destroyed. They have no tents, very, very little food, certainly no potable water, and medical attention is just the very minimal. And at this little Pakistani military base I was at, they were bringing in very serious, this is like a week after the earthquake, these people were still bringing in seriously injured people on rope beds and stretchers after walks of from 4 to 8 hours out of the mountains to try and get to this helicopter pad to get people helilifted to a hospital. I mean, it's just really heartbreaking to see the suffering up there.
Incredible
and
pictures.
On top of all that,
yes.
In the afternoon, it starts to cloud up, it gets cold, it starts to rain, and in the higher elevations, I was about at 5,000 feet, at about 10,000 feet, it's snowing already, and it's only October. So if things aren't being done very, very quickly, the population is really at risk from the elements.
And Ron, have there been estimates on how large that at-risk population is? How many people are stuck or vulnerable in the mountains now?
Well, I mean, the people are saying now 20% of the people in the affected area, which would be tens and who knows, maybe hundreds of thousands of people haven't even been reached yet by any kind of relief operation. So I'm sure there are, you know, certainly well over 100,000 people who are just stranded, totally isolated. And that is in addition to probably the 2.5 million homeless that we know about that are generally in the cities and the more accessible mountain valley areas.
And what about the dimensions of the area hit by this quake, Ron? Can you describe it? Is it a 50 by 50 miles, 100 by 100, more or less? How broad a swath of that mountainous terrain hit by the quake?
Well, I think that's a problem. That may be a fairly good estimate. It may be like 50 miles, I mean, the worst part area, maybe about 50 or 60 miles north, south, and 50, 60 miles east, west. That covers an awful lot of territory and a population probably of about 4 million people, I'd say.
And finally, Ron, what about Pakistan's sense of international aid at this point? Are they expressing satisfaction with the degree to which the world has come to their help?
I think they're very happy with the outpouring of international aid, and both in kind and in money that they're getting. And especially, they're especially delighted with the helicopters that have been brought in by the United States, Switzerland, and even Germany. But the U.S. has provided most of the choppers. Unfortunately, I think the Pakistanis are making a big mistake for political reasons to have rejected an Indian offer to send in helicopters, which are right up across the ceasefire line, where the Indians have a lot of helicopters, into Pakistan, because the Pakistanis don't want the Indians, showing them up or bringing in those helicopters. But they could certainly be useful. And hopefully the need of the local people may make the Pakistani government change their mind in the future.
But so far, a sign of how deep those political and military tensions run, even in a time of disaster like this. Ron Morrow, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tom.
Ron Morrow, South Asia Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Islamabad, Pakistan. Before New Orleans, the tsunami, and last week's 7.6 earthquake in Kashmir, there was San Francisco. At 5:12 a.m., April 18th, 1906, an earthquake registering 8.25 on the Richter scale struck the Golden Gate City. 3,000 people died, and more than 200,000 were left homeless. A century later, it still ranks as one of the most significant quakes of all time. Author and trained geologist Simon Winchester has a new book on the 1906 earthquake that takes a fresh look at the social, political, and geological forces that collided on that fateful day. And if you think Pakistan is bad, wait until you hear his warning on the next big one in California. This hour on Point, the San Francisco earthquake of 1906 and its tremors today. You can join the conversation. What is it about human nature that keeps us building and living on fault lines, floodplains, and hurricane zones? Are we better at handling natural disasters today than we were a century ago, or worse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Vancouver, Canada, is Simon Winchester, best-selling author, geologist, and globe-trotting correspondent. His new book is A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. He's also author of the bestsellers Krakatoa, The Professor and the Madman, and The Map That Changed the World. Simon Winchester, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom, and just to get it on the record, I'm actually in Calgary, not in Vancouver.
Calgary. We want to have you placed in just the right place, somewhere up there, and we're delighted to have you. You know, we're going to hear about the geology and the response and all the rest, but I was struck by your description of this moment at 1906, this kind of hinge point between the Edwardian world, the Victorian era, the old days, and the modern world. This moment in history at which this quake showed up, I wish you'd remind us of some of the indicators of what was emerging in 1906, from cars to Morse code and the rest, Simon.
Well, I think the most significant, at least symbolically, is the fact that Einstein had just come up with the theory of relativity. So one might say that this was the first earthquake, the first natural catastrophe of the atomic age. But all sorts of other things were happening. The radio diode was invented, Morse code, as you said, a little bit before that. Cars were beginning to make the transcontinental journey. I think it took about 52 days to get from one side of the country to the other. But it did seem in many ways that we had at last turned our back on the sort of fusty, tweedy, pipe-smoking times of Victorian and Edwardian to the beginnings of the modern era. And then came this catastrophe, and our reaction to it in many ways reflected the fact that the era had changed, because up to that point, all natural catastrophes were regarded as the work of an angry god. After that, specifically at this hinge point, as you put it, of San Francisco, we began to look at these events rationally and started to say, why did it happen? Let's work out what goes mad below the surface of the earth that causes it to topple our cities. And that, I think, is makes San Francisco particularly important.
We'll look at what went on beneath the surface of the earth. We just got a minute before a short break here. But when the quake was over, Simon Winchester, what did it look like in San Francisco in 1906?
Well, what really was the most devastating aspect was the fire. The city was ruined, all because the buildings were hopelessly unprepared for an attack of an 8.25 rupture in the San Andreas Fault. Mm. But then it ruptured all the gas mains and the electrical wires arced, and so fires began all over the city, and they coalesced into one or two huge fires, which became like firestorms, like in Dresden and Tokyo. And this consumed the city for the next 3.5 days. And so the whole city was left a smoking ruin. So earthquake first brought the buildings down, and then fire finished it off.
The whole city, if you looked out from Nob Hill in those days, you would have seen, what, just acre after acre of burnt, destroyed landscape?
You would, and there is extraordinarily quite a lot of film footage, very jerky Edison, black and white, obviously, film footage, which shows buildings still collapsing. I mean, there was actual on-the-spot film, and everything is collapsed. There are just ruined buildings and streets full of dead animals and dead people and endless columns of smoke and fire, and surrounded, of course, by all the natural beauty that is San Francisco. After the weather cleared up 3 days later, it became beautiful again, but total, total devastation.
We're going to look into that and to the response of that. Simon Winchester is with us. His new book is A Crack in the Edge of the World. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. What echoes do you see, do you hear? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the great San Francisco quake of 1906 and its tremors today. My guest this hour, Simon Winchester, joining us from Calgary, Canada, author of the new book, A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. You can join us. What is it about human beings, I ask again, that keeps us building and living on fault lines, floodplains, and hurricane zones? And this, do Americans handle disaster differently today, and you'll hear in a moment, differently today than in the day of Teddy Roosevelt, telegraph lines and train travel? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Simon Winchester writes of Enrico Caruso being in San Francisco on that fateful morning in 1906. He was in town to perform the opera Carmen. He was the superstar singer of that day. Let's listen to what he had to say about the impact of the quake. These are his words read by an actor in the Discovery Channel documentary 1906, The Great Quake Cover-Up.
But what an awakening. I woke up about 5 o'clock, feeling in my bed, rocking as though I am in a ship on the ocean. I get up and go to the window, raise the shade and look out. And what I see makes me tremble with fear. I see buildings toppling over, big pieces of masonry falling, and from the street below I hear the cries and screams of men and women and children.
Okay, it's a little over the top. It's the Discovery Channel's version of the Italian opera star Enrico Caruso describing what he saw that morning. Simon Winchester, what was the state of San Francisco on the eve of this quake? We know Caruso was performing Carmen. What other resources and wealth and populations were gathered in this unique American city on that eve?
Well, you've got to remember it was a very young city, formed only in 1849, and then suddenly got this big boost from the gold rush, and thousands of people piled into the city hoping for a fortune. Many of them, most of them, were men initially, and then a few women of somewhat easy virtue followed them. And the city became known essentially as one non-stop Saturnalia. I mean, to give you one idea, there was an enormous hotel, a 1,000-room hotel called the Hotel Nymphomania, which sort of suggests the mood of the moment. Well, by the turn of the century, things had somewhat calmed down, and on top of this sort of bawdy, rambunctious reputation that San Francisco rightly had, was built a sort of formalism to a city that the presidency in Washington decided should be the imperial capital of the West. America had these big interests in the Philippines, in China, in Japan, And to project its power across the Pacific Ocean, you needed a mighty, mighty port with an impressive facade. And that's what San Francisco was starting to become. So it was a facade with beautiful buildings starting to go up, but underneath it, the somewhat seamy and somewhat bawdy bacchanalian city. And so on the evening, sure enough, there was Caruso warbling his way through Carmen. There was John Barrymore trying to pick up chorus girls. There were restaurants bursting at the seams, well-dressed swells and their beautiful women in carriages going up and down the streets. And then, because it was a Tuesday night, not a Friday or Saturday, the city began to calm down at about 1:30 or 2. And by 2 o'clock, the city was quiet. Caruso was in his bed asleep. And everything shut down. And then at 12 minutes past five, it went completely mad.
We're going to look at what happened when it went mad, but take us into the geology here for a minute, the geology that's still at work along the Pacific Rim there, the San Andreas Fault and the bigger plate movements that it was and is part of. What was building beneath San Francisco and the California coast and why?
Well, what we know now and what we significantly did not know back in 1906 is that San Francisco sits almost exactly on top of one of the great plate boundaries between the North America plate, where you in Boston are sitting and where I in Calgary are sitting, and where, in fact, everyone to the west of Iceland is sitting. In California, however, and in San Francisco specifically, that plate comes to an end and it joins or abuts onto another plate called the Pacific Plate. The significant thing about the Pacific Plate is that it is moving northwards an inch and a half every single year. And it's being held by friction, rather like rust on a brake plate, from actually shifting against the North American plate until these stresses build up to an completely impossible position. And that's what they do every 100, 150 years. And that's what happened at 12 minutes past five on the morning of Wednesday, April the 18th. Suddenly this 1.5 inches a year tension, which had been building up for 150 years, suddenly gave. And there was this huge rupture and this set, this vibration coursing 7,000 or 8,000 miles an hour under the streets of San Francisco and completely wrecked it.
Describe what that looked like, would have looked like, if you were standing on top of one of San Francisco's famous hills and looking out over the bay. Where was the epicenter, and how did the quake's impact hit the city? How did it appear?
Well, it used to be thought that the impact occurred, that the epicenter was in a town called Olima, which is about 20 miles north of San Francisco, because that is where the greatest movement of the earth took place, at 21 feet. On the both sides of the fault, it shifted in Olima. But in fact, they now know the epicenter was just off the coast in a place called Daly City, just to the south of San Francisco. And from this point, these waves radiated principally eastwards towards the city and towards Oakland. And if you were standing, as a policeman was, in the Embarcadero, looking westwards towards the Pacific Ocean, which is about 6 miles away, you would have seen, looking up the hills, looking up Nob Hill and then towards Pacific Heights and so forth, you would have seen Washington Street looking like a great tsunami, if you like, but of concrete as it was bucking up and down and up and down, and the buildings on top of it rearing towards you and then rearing backwards again and rearing forwards and then falling, the tops of them, and then them cracking, and then huge cracks opening up in the street, coming shooting towards you, and then the electrical lines falling down and the wires on them arcing and causing great flashing and gas lines breaking and columns of gas shooting into the air from these ruptures in the street and igniting with these sparks. And then fountains of water where the water mains ruptured, rendering the water mains then dry and completely useless for the firefighters who would later try desperately to take charge of this fire. So it was complete chaos for 48 seconds. That was the length of time that these waves ruptured through San Francisco. Then there was terrible silence for about a minute. And then there were the screams of the injured, and then the fires began to break out.
And there's the kind of scene from hell of San Francisco, 1906. We could go deeper and deeper into the destruction, but with Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, so recently behind us, what we see in Pakistan right now, the response of the city and its neighbors and Americans right across the country is remarkable for us to hear today. You write of the telegram that went out from San Francisco, the telegraph still being a pretty new technology then. I forget the exact words, but something along the lines, very simple, San Francisco in ruins. And you write that the country, even spread out just along telegraph lines and trains and without all the resources that we have at our disposal today, responded with remarkable immediacy and alacrity to that simple cry for help.
It is quite astonishing to look back on it. I mean, what happened initially is that the deputy chief of the army in San Francisco, a man called Frederick Funston, was tossed out of bed at 12 minutes past five, realized that he needed to take charge, wrote a message to his adjutant down in the army barracks, the Presidio, found a horseman, said, gallop down the hill to the Presidio, give this note to my adjutant, and tell him we need all available soldiers in full battle gear to present themselves to the mayor of San Francisco. 2.5 hours later, 153 minutes to be precise, after the earthquake, two companies of soldiers with bayonets, with ammunition, in full battle gear, presented themselves to the mayor, who was a very unprepossessing sort of fellow. He was the violinist in a jazz club. He was president of the City Musicians Union. He was a highly corrupt man, too. San Francisco had a very, very corrupt government. But he also rose to the occasion. He said, OK, these soldiers I have, first of all, there's to be no looting. Any looter will be shot dead, without question.
Period.
I need dynamite in large quantities because these fires are breaking out. We need to establish fire breaks. I need to commandeer, without asking any questions, a boat to send a telegram from Oakland, where I suspect the cable lines are still working, to say we need help. He did that. Washington, when it got the message, reacted, as you say, with astonishing speed. Congress met at 4 o'clock the following morning, passing all the necessary enabling legislation. Mm. Relief trains were ordered out from all the barracks in the central and eastern United States, thundering over the Rockies, including the longest hospital train ever assembled. The first train actually arrived from Southern California on midnight of the night of the earthquake. Within a week, every single tent that was in the possession of the American Army was pitched in San Francisco, providing housing for the 250,000 people that were homeless. Within 2 weeks, a tenth of the entire American standing army was on point in San Francisco. The country responded to its wounded city amazingly quickly.
Is it just our imagination, or are we a little fearful of drawing comparisons between that response and the Katrina response? It doesn't look, on the face of it, too flattering to Americans today with all the resources.
Sadly, it doesn't. I mean, considering we've got, you know, cell phones and CNN and everything technological.
Supersonic transport, yeah.
Yes, precisely. I don't know. It'll take a long time to decide why it was that the Katrina response was so bad, but it was an intellectual failure. It wasn't a technological failure. People weren't willing to step up to the plate and take the kind of decisive decisions because they were always afraid either of bureaucratic implications or, worst of all, legal implications. I mean, the order that Schmitz issued, the mayor, saying, I'm going to shoot looters on the spot, was manifestly illegal, but he didn't care, and he restored order. And he said, I'll worry about that kind of thing later. Funston had no authority to deploy federal troops in the San Francisco area.
The military
area
chief,
right,
he did it.
But he did it. And because of that, San Francisco got back on its feet in double quick time and is the city that it is today.
A century on, it is a very illuminating comparison. Simon Winchester is with us. His new book is A Crack in the Edge of the World. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. And Simon, they're lining up to do just that. Let me turn to Tina in Mason, New Hampshire. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
You have recently just touched upon the subject I was calling about. I was wondering if the author might, again, draw a comparison between the socioeconomic impact that the earthquake had made in San Francisco versus Hurricane Katrina in our southern states, and if he might shed some light as to the impact, especially on our lower-income families who had been affected, and if there were more lower-income families and possibly immigrants in the San Francisco area affected differently than the more affluent citizens.
Great question. Another then and now. Tina, we'll pick it up. Simon Winchester, it's still early days on Katrina, we know, though we saw the immediate aftermath. But what about the socioeconomic impact and then legacy of this quake? And can you draw comparisons to today?
I think you can. I mean, without meaning to make a facetious pun, earthquakes are great levelers, and they tend to afflict the wealthy and the poor. Not perhaps so much today, because wealthy people tend to live in well-built houses, whereas the poor do not. But back in 1906 San Francisco, even the big houses were badly built. And so you got the wealthy and their diamonds in the streets. You got Enrico Caruso and John Barrymore in the streets. Mm-hmm. But you also got a lot of working class people. In terms of racial, how it played out in a racial mm-hmm. sense, there is one very, very interesting subtext to all of this. And that's what happened to Chinatown. Chinatown was completely destroyed. It existed where it does today. And this was at a time when you had the Chinese Exclusion Act, in fact, on the statute books federally in America.
Restricting immigration.
Restricting immigrations. I mean, there was loathing and fear of the Chinese. And when their Chinatown was razed to the ground by first the earthquake and then the fire, it was suggested that they not be allowed to come back. Mm. And several prominent businessmen, there was a committee mainly of Scots, Irish people who lived in San Francisco, saying this is a heaven-sent opportunity, they should be forbidden from being here. But then from Peking, from Beijing, came word from the Dowager Empress, still on the throne yes. over in China, mm-hmm. saying, don't you dare. There is Chinese-owned property in downtown San Francisco where I have my consulate, and if you dare move the people from Chinatown, I promise you there will be no business between the United States of America and the Republic of China anymore. And so Washington buckled, San Francisco buckled, Chinatown was rebuilt precisely where it stands today and is, of course, the model of prosperity that we know so well.
Amazing that the Empress Dowager weighing in 1906 on an earthquake in San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Simon, what about the longer-term economic redevelopment of San Francisco after the quake? What shape did it take? How did it go?
Well, a number of things to say about that. First of all, it missed a golden opportunity to rebuild itself in a very, very dramatic and beautiful way. Daniel Burnham, the man who essentially planned most of contemporary Washington, D.C., did a lot of work in Chicago, had drawn up a plan for transforming what was a very higgledy-piggledy sort of city into something really noble with wide avenues and marvelous marble buildings. But the city fathers said, no, this is a city which has a need to get back into business quickly, and so we're going to build on the old lot lines. And so Burnham was sent packing, and San Francisco, with all its sort of complexities, rose again essentially in exactly the same pattern that it holds today. But there was a significant other thing that happened. I think there was a realization in California that having a city built on top of a fault line was in fact very unwise, because inevitably again it was going to be damaged sometime in the future. And so slowly, almost imperceptibly, the capital, the economic capital of California, shifted south to Los Angeles. And so this period, sort of 1906 to 1920, was a period when San Francisco's primacy in California ebbed away and the primacy took over in Southern California. And obviously, a lot of other things occurred, the film industry, the blessing of the climate in the South. But the fact of the matter is that Los Angeles is not on the San Andreas Fault and is therefore a much safer place to be. Yes, they have earthquakes there, but they're not nearly as bad. San Francisco is right on the fault, and one day it's going to be destroyed again. And that significantly limited its growth.
So for all the kind of courage, lads, let's move ahead, it did mean a shift from San Francisco to L.A. of California, of West Coast power.
It was a tipping point, the realization that San Francisco is, in fact, beautiful though it may be, a very dangerous place to live.
Simon Winchester is with us. His new book is A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. We've got to take a short break here. We'll come to your questions, your calls. When we come back, you can join us. What's your fear for California next time? And do you hear echoes from 1906, flattering or otherwise, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906 and its tremors today. My guest is Simon Winchester, author of bestsellers Krakatoa, The Professor and the Madman, The Map That Changed the World, and now his new book, A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Daniel's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Daniel?
So, Mr. Winchester, I have a question for you specifically. My question pertains to the desire to rebuild and the need to rebuild. And it's apropos both to the situation today, as well as the situation in San Francisco. And, you know, it seems that there is a quintessential human need to try again, which ties, I think, to the fact that there really isn't a safe city any longer, if there ever truly was. I mean, I'm in Boston, which also, as we know, is on a fault line. But I think even if you were to try and get to the center of the country, you'd have, you know, issues around tornadoes, et cetera. There's no safe place. And I wonder how much that kind of ties into the whole rebuilding of San Francisco and what will be the rebuilding of New Orleans.
Simon Winchester, I know you cut out for just a second there, but you have the question?
Yes, I did. I heard it. And I think it opens a Pandora's box. It's a fascinating question. I've been thinking about it a lot recently in the light of Katrina, particularly. Europe, where obviously I come from, mm-hmm. and Asia, many ancient countries, their cities that exist today are where they should be. So London, Berlin, Moscow, Paris, they've been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. They're in stable places and they're not afflicted terribly by weather. But there are many ruined cities that were built where they shouldn't have been built. So Pompeii, Herculaneum, Heliopolis, Petra, Ayutthaya. Mm. We go there as tourists to visit these ruins. Mm-hmm. America is a country without any ruins at all, apart from one or two ghost towns in the far west. It's a young country. Eventually, I think, it'll shake itself down such that the cities that are built where they should be will survive, and the cities are built incautiously will not be there any longer. And I think if you look at a map of America in, let's say, 500 years' time, you have to ask yourself, even though it may be a heretical question to pose now, will, for instance, New Orleans be there? I mean, it is, when you think about it, lunacy to build a city 20 feet below sea level, between a river and a lake, in the path of hurricanes. So I think that probably New Orleans in 100, 200 years' time, people will get exasperated with rebuilding it and say, OK, it'll be a ruin. We visit as tourists. Similarly, the cities of the Arizona desert, I mean, Phoenix and Tucson, maybe even Vegas. Mm. I mean, there is no water there. They will, I think, eventually wither and die, and we'll visit them as ruins. And one has then to ask about San Francisco itself. I mean, it is folly to build a city on one of the most dangerous plate boundaries in the planet. We are never going to master the technology to overcome the relentless motion of the Pacific Plate. It is going to keep building up tension, and the cities of Oakland and San Francisco are going to be hit again and again and again. And rather like a boxer just going down for the count so often that his second just throws in the towel, I think once again, I know it's a heresy and a lot of people will not want to hear this, but I think in 100 years, 200 years' time, we will go to the stumps of the Golden Gate Bridge and the stumps of the Transamerica Tower and say, much as we might say if we went to Petra today, my, this must have been a great city, but what folly to build it there.
What an amazing image. Humans don't give up easily, but ultimately, you say, nature, the logic of nature will out. Daniel, thank you for your call. Dennis is calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, this is just a minor point about how one effect of the earthquake on popular culture. I remember when I was a kid, my mother telling me that when she was a teenager, how moved she was by the movie San Francisco with Clark Gable and, you know, the scenes of him digging through the rubble for Jeanette McDonald, and how it brought her to tears. And I guess that was a prototype of the disaster movie that we have, you know,
right,
today, but based on a real event. And so that movie would have been made, I guess, in the mid-30s.
1934.
And was a big-budget MGM movie.
Disaster film, I guess. Dennis, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Simon, how about the depiction there with Clark Gable? Was it accurate? Was it mythological?
It's uncannily accurate, and I think the closing scenes are astonishingly well done, considering it was 1934, and really moving. I think the caller of Dennis is absolutely right, and I think when Jeanette McDonald sings San Francisco at the end, you know, San Francisco, mm-hmm. open your golden gate, well, I won't sing it, but it's a truly wonderful film, and considering the technology of the time, I mean, George Lucas, eat your heart out, basically.
Great. Lee is calling from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee, you're on the air.
Fine, thanks. My question is, how broad would it be? Would it affect the peninsula? Would it get over the water, the bridge to Berkeley and Oakland? How broad would this big one be?
If the big one, when the big one next comes, you mean, Lee?
Exactly.
Simon Winchester, what about it? Paint a picture of what's likely to be next. Or is that possible? Is it a fool's errand to try that?
No, I think it's very possible because the U.S. Geological Survey has done very careful calculations. They say now that they believe there's a 62% probability of a magnitude 6.5 earthquake or greater, striking not the San Andreas Fault, but the Hayward Fault, which runs more or less parallel to it on the east side of the bay under the cities of Oakland, Berkeley, and Richmond before the year 2032. When that happens, and this reflects much of what an earlier caller said, there are a lot of extremely poor people that live particularly in Richmond, a lot of factories, a lot of sort of low-standard housing. The infrastructure isn't nearly as sympathetically built as it is in downtown San Francisco. So I think we're going to get a major, major problem. And the big question in the East Bay, fairly soon, and I know there's sophisticated emergency management headquarters all over the place with, you know, sharpened pencils and freeze-dried coffee and plasma screen televisions and satellite telephones. But I think the question that has to be asked in the wake of Katrina is, are the people that are supposedly managing this next disaster the right people? They clearly weren't at Katrina. Are they when the next one, and it is going to be, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. When it hits the Bay Area, are the right people in charge?
And what about, could we see kind of an eking out of this tension in mini-quakes that would leave things intact? Or is it baked in the cake that it's going to be a giant wallop? Is it going to bring those stumps of the Golden Gate Bridge to reality, as you describe them?
Well, maybe not this time around, but inevitably, because without getting unduly technical, the northern third of this 720-mile-long thing, the San Andreas Fault, is locked, as it were, by rust. And every so often, it overcomes the friction of that rust and gives you an almighty wallop. The comfort some San Franciscans might have derived from the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, which you might say was a sort of mini precursor of the big one, is a false dawn for them, because that wasn't on the San Andreas Fault, it was on a neighbour fault. So that tension, which I described, this inch and a half a year, is building up, so now it's 15 feet's worth of tension. Sooner or later it's got to give, and I think the current thinking is that it's not going to give in a series of, as you say, little microquakes, but one almighty wallop. That's what they've got to be prepared for.
And what about right on across California, beyond the immediate Bay Area? What's the expected hit?
The Sierra essentially stop it spreading eastward very much, but it does spread north and south. So, for instance, cities like Santa Rosa in the north would probably be affected, and all the way down to San Jose in the south. So it's an area, maybe a lozenge-shaped area, maybe 100 miles from north to south. But I should say also that America is a very seismically active continent. I mean, there was a huge earthquake in Charleston in 1886, mm-hmm. and most sinister of all, New Madrid, Missouri, right in the middle, mm-hmm. right on the Mississippi River, mm-hmm. 1811, one of the biggest quakes ever known in the history of the United States. If that were to happen again, and geologists are somewhat perplexed as to why New Madrid is as active as it is, because it shouldn't be. It's right in the middle of the country. When that goes, then cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati are also in trouble. I don't want to be a Cassandra here. It's just that this is an active country. People have got to take care.
Simon Winchester, we've just got a couple of minutes here. Early on and at the end, you get a bit philosophical here. You quote Sir Thomas Browne early on. He says, "The created world is but a small parenthesis in eternity," thinking like a geologist, great spans of time there. And you write yourself, "All that humans do and everywhere that humans inhabit is for the moment only, like the cherry blossoms in a Japanese springtime, exquisite simply by virtue of their very impermanence." Is that what you take away from the story of the California quake? Humans are tenacious at the same time. What's the balance you see here?
We are tenacious, but I think our tenacity in the face of what the planet can hurl at us is essentially pointless. I talk a bit about the inevitability of an enormous volcano under Yellowstone. That's going to destroy most of the west of the United States. It's going to come. But I was giving a talk, I think, in Kansas City a few months ago about this. And I said, but don't worry anybody, because, yes, this will happen, but it probably won't happen for 250,000 years, by which time humankind will be extinct. And a very alarmed woman jumped up from the front row and she said, what? She said, what? Even Americans will be extinct? She was somewhat incredulous that we are just passing like mayflies in geological time. We're not going to be here forever, so we better jolly well make as much use of the time we spend here as humankind as we possibly can.
As much as we possibly can. You give us a big glimpse into one very hard moment in that time, Simon Winchester, and we thank you for it, and thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Simon Winchester, author of The Professor and the Madman, The Map That Changed the World, Krakatoa, and now A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. Iraqi citizens head to the polls Saturday to cast their vote for or against the country's new constitution. There are now 15.5 million registered voters in Iraq. Gaining a majority of their support for the draft constitution is critical to White House plans for the country. This week, U.S. officials brokered a last-minute deal to defuse opposition from some Sunni leaders. Others continue to call for a no vote. Meanwhile, expecting violence over this voting weekend, U.S. and Iraqi security forces are on high alert. For the latest from Baghdad, I'm joined now by Bobby Ghosh, senior correspondent for Time magazine in Baghdad. Bobby, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
It sounds like a rough line, but first, just to begin, Bobby, what can you tell us about preparations for this weekend's voting? What is the security situation there?
Well, Tom, the country is under blanket security. For the last 3 days, there's been an all-day curfew in most of the large cities. Baghdad has been virtually a ghost town. No cars or vehicles, private vehicles of any kind are allowed into the streets. That will also be the case tomorrow, so people will have to walk to their nearest polling booths to cast their vote. It's exactly as it was on the 30th of January when this country had its first free election after Saddam Hussein. There are police and military, very obvious police and military presence everywhere, almost every major street in every major intersection. You can see IPOs and police vans and cars. There is very clearly a very, very high degree of alert.
With that kind of security blanket and the fear that of violence that has clearly produced it, what kind of turnout is expected, both out of security concerns and for a long time there was a boycott encouraged here. What is the expected turnout, or is it possible to anticipate?
Well, I think we can look to the January election to get our clues about what sort of turnout to expect, and the situation was exactly the same. In January, a sizable part under almost constant terrorist attack, as it is today, there was near complete in the country as it is today, and a big chunk of the Sunni population were boycotting the vote as they are today. But despite all of that, the turnout in January was nearly 60%, which is quite remarkable for a country that is effectively still in a state of war. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if we reach that figure again tomorrow.
A Sunni boycott has long been expected here, but then maybe not. Maybe an effort to vote this constitution down. Now some saying they may support it. What is expected from the Sunni population over the weekend?
I think the safest bet is that there will be a much larger Sunni turnout than there was in January, because at least one large Sunni party, the largest Sunni party, which is known as the Iraqi Islamic Party, has signed on to the constitution and has asked its supporters to vote yes in the referendum tomorrow. Most of the other Sunni parties, and collectively they represent the majority of the community, have asked their supporters to vote no. So I think there will be a high Sunni turnout, more voting no than voting yes, but the fact that they're voting at all indicates an investment in the political process, which is a positive development.
And how are observers there now laying odds on the likelihood of this draft constitution being approved in this vote in a firm and final way?
Well, almost nobody is predicting that the constitution, that the referendum will fail. Everybody assumes that it will succeed. A simple majority, 51%, will do fine. Most likely it will pass by a much larger margin than that. It would take a two-thirds majority of voters in three provinces to vote no for the constitution to fail, and that scenario at this point is very, very unlikely.
When are results likely to be known after the weekend voting, Bobby?
We should know by late Sunday at the latest, I think, exactly which way the wind is blowing.
Bobby Ghosh in Baghdad, senior correspondent for Time magazine. We're very grateful to you for being with us. Good luck and be safe over the weekend. Thanks for your report.
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
Bobby Ghosh in Baghdad. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.